Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Church Planner Podcast. This is Peyton Jones, and I am here today with a friend of mine. You know him, especially if you're a friend of this podcast. I've got Brian Sanders with me. He is the founder of the Underground Network, but he also serves as the VP of Impact Alliances for the National Christian Foundation. Now, he also wrote The Underground Church and probably one of my all-time favorite books, The Six Seasons of Calling. I read it cover to cover on an airplane, could not put it down. It was so well written. Brian, welcome.
Thanks, man. That was sweet. I didn't expect that. I'm glad you liked that.
Yeah, I'm going back and reading that actually this year. That's on my list to reread because I'm getting old, Brian. I'm 52.
We are. You can't stop it, man. You cannot stop it.
Yeah, it's funny, and I'm not saying this, I don't say this to every guest, Brian, but it's like I'm sitting on the plane. I kept telling my wife, I kept leaning over, listen to this. You know when you do that, like when you're reading a book, listen to what he's saying here.
It hits you at the right time. Exactly.
I'm trying to watch my movie here, Peyton, So, hey, I had this book drop. Everybody knows because I won't be quiet about it, but we dropped a book called Disciplology and also an everyday, that's a catalyst guide, an everyday disciple maker book, which is called Journey to Disciple Making. Because when you decide you're going to make disciples, Jesus had a promise, follow me and I will make you fishers of people. And so that goes along with it for the everyday disciple maker. But there's also an app because you can't gate movement behind a paywall or a book. It'll never happen. So the app is free and everything in that everyday disciple making journey guide, that is in the app because that's just what we do, man. We're in this for love of the game and mission, not for money. So that's out there. It's been released out into the wild. It is free. You can go to disciplology.com to figure it out. But I wanted to talk with Brian because he is one of, everybody knows this, he is a mobilizer. Brian, you have mobilized everyday believers. I know that you believe that people just have an internal, innate, unique gift mix within them. And that is almost like a cocktail, like that blends together for this passionate mission that each person can engage in. And so, man, like you sat with me, you and Brad Briscoe, and talked about church plantology. And I asked, hey, Brian, would you come on? And you graciously said yes. So that was why I had you on here today.
The sequel.
Yeah. Ology Rides Again, Son of Ology.
It does ride again. Which, by the way, I do think this is your best book, by the way, that this current one is quite good. So,
yeah. Thanks, brother. Hey, that meant a lot to me because I don't know if you're like me when you write a book, it's never good enough. So, I'm still in that edit mode where, I can't see.
You got to let it go, man.
You can't let me anywhere near it or I'll get consumed till 2:30 in the morning marking it up. I should have changed this. Mm-hmm. But, yep, had to let it go. It's released. It's gone. It's out in the wild. My baby grew up. But first question, Brian. We can just kind of make this more like a dialogue. But in your experience as a church planner, the underground movement, mobilizer, disciple maker, what comes first, chicken or the egg? Is it disciple making or church planning?
Yeah, I think I know what you mean by disciple making because now that I've read lots of your stuff and I definitely get it. and also what do we mean by church planting? That also we could suffer what's called the fallacy of equivocation. I mean one thing when I think of church planting, but I think probably what you're getting at is that we could probably think about church planting as something which is like non-relational. You just show up in a town and you send out some flyers and, you know, have a launch service or something like that. And then now suddenly you have a church. And I'm not sure that's, I hope no one listening still thinks that's the way to do it, but, I highly doubt it. But yeah, I mean, I would say actually that the precursor to even disciple making is mission itself, like to feel that kind of, sort of a breaching of the kingdom of this world. Like, where's the front line for me? Where am I going to penetrate Christian to the non-Christian world? You know, so where am I going to step into? Who are the people I'm trying to reach or love or know or whatever? And yet, and that dynamic sense of I am called to fill in the blank to that neighborhood or that city or that people group or that demographic or whatever, and then to show up there with good news, you know, with hospitality, with servanthood, with compassion, with whatever, all the tools of the kingdom, all the goods of the kingdom. And then yes, to want to see if some disciples start to be made and to see if disciples emerge, like people that are hungry for Jesus, like the kind of Luke 10, you know, you show up and you say, the kingdom is here. Anybody care? Anybody interested? Mm-hmm. You know, and if they're not, you're meant to move on, you know, so you don't plant a church anyway. You wait and see, is that received? Does your peace rest on that place? And I think that's probably what you mean by disciple making. It's like the beginning stages of disciples. So churches, I think you would agree with this, and you say what you think, but churches are meant to emerge from the soil of mission because disciples are being formed. So yes. People now you have people who are Christian or Jesus people, and they need to know each other and be in relationship with each other. That's called the church. So you can't really plant. I don't know what it is we're doing.
Right.
If you're starting without disciples, I suppose you could start with someone else's disciples. Like you're planning a church because somebody else made disciples and you're just like taking them because you have better music or something. But, that's probably not great either.
No, I love, you know, it's so cool, man, because when I talk to you and getting to know you over the years, you are this cool balance between a highly analytical mind and a prophetic soul. Like those two things come together in Brian Sanders in a big way. And, you know, it's cool because it stood out to me. And, you know, I mean, a little slow on the uptake sometimes, but it hits, you know, different things hit you in stages. I think when you start reading the Bible, you take so much for granted. Like you stop seeing things in the Bible in a weird way. And sometimes you don't always get the big picture. And it really hit me that Jesus he didn't plant a church at all. Like he doesn't parachute drop into Acts and go, hey, everybody, let's start multiplying churches. He starts with mobilization. He's planting people. And
he could have done that, Peyton. Like he definitely had the gift set to just draw a crowd.
Absolutely. Yep. And instead, he shuns the crowds. He gets rid of them, you know, so many times. And then you watch the Apostle Paul later where he stops planting churches. Like he's trying to go real fast in Galatia, you know, plant, 3 months, 4 months, 3 months with the Galatian network. And that leads to heresy. It's one of the things about DMM. That actually can be problematic is heresy spreads fast if you don't spend time in teaching and you're just focused on tactics. And I think I always tell people when I left this country in 99, bigger was better. It was mega church boom. And when I got back, faster was better. And I think Jesus kind of teaches us, no, better's better. You know, like time teaching tactics, you're going to make disciples. And I don't know if you've noticed, but with me, I've noticed if I talk to a room full of young people about church planting, they don't care anymore. But if I talk about embodying Christ in your community, exactly what you talked about, the kingdom, they light up and it really is church planting. That's what church planting is. is embodying Christ in a community. And it's a great commission, right? Like for me, I look at the Great Commission. I see going as the apostolic, baptizing as the evangelist, teaching as the teacher, to obey is, you know, the shepherd, you know, life transformation
That's
and community.
Cool. Yeah.
And then lastly, I'll be with you to the end, power and presence of the Holy Spirit. Those were the five things Jesus did. And he's like, these are the five tactics of disciple making. Making disciples, do these five things, disciples be formed in the image of Christ. And then a community is formed in the image of Christ. And now you've got this Christ embodied at the heart of a community.
Yeah, was it, is it McGovern or whoever that, or no, Roberts? Anyway, the idea, like if your church were to disappear tomorrow, would the community even care? Would they know,
so
you know?
Good.
And that kind of penetrating question. But if you start, like you're saying, if you started with showing up in a community and being meaningful to that community in some way, and the disciples are being formed, people are coming to faith, a church emerges, well, then that would be like, that's our church. Like it belongs to the community. It would be part of the fabric of that place, you know?
Yeah.
And it would be missed, you know, it would be vital in some way. So I suppose if you start it right, it would be needed, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. What you've spoken before about how microchurches mobilize more believers than most traditional churches. Why do you think it's easier to mobilize people in disciple making when it's a smaller expression?
I took a walk last week in my neighborhood and I was with my wife and we were walking around and we come up on these three boys. They're kind of on one side of the street. I'm going to say one of them is like 12. He was a little bit taller and the other two were like 9 or 10 and they were just taking rocks and they were chucking them at this house across the street. Okay. So they're just winging rocks across the street. So I don't know exactly what's going on. As I walk up, I'm like, I'm like, guys, are you trying to, is there a target? Like, are you shooting for something? And one of them goes, yeah, I'm shooting for the mailbox or something. And the other one goes, we're shooting for the house. And then the third one said, we're trying to hit their windows. So I was kind of like, whoa, like what's going on here? Like, where are your parents? You know, these three little hoodlums are basically trying to not take out the windows of their neighbor across the street. And it's not an empty house. Like someone lives in that house and they're just winging rocks. But here's the thing. When I walked up, like as soon as we walked up, they stopped. They got kind of proper upright. They're like, hello, how are you? And they were very courteous boys. They were sort of like, they had some politeness and so on. And so that's why I was like, hey, what's your target? What are you trying to hit? And they're like, we're trying to take out the windows. And I was like, okay, guys, you can't like, no, don't break this person's windows, please. And I kept walking. And Peyton, they're very polite. They're very courteous. They're obviously trained to talk to adults with respect and so on. But as soon as I walked by, they just kept throwing the rocks.
Oh, wow.
So I had no impact on them at all. So this is my, I tell you that story because it's like a metaphor for sort of transient, itinerant teaching or discipleship or something like that, where people that are not really in your life pass by your life for a moment and you sit up straight and you stand when they say stand and you sing the songs and you listen to the words and you know, they make sense and I hear you. And then you just go back to your life. The person discipling those boys was the older boy. This is my theory, you know, like that was their discipler, not me. And even though there was some respect there, maybe even some listening, and even though I may have thought, oh, I taught them something, I didn't, you know, it's proximity, dude. It's who's in your life, who knows you. This is what matters. And actually, it probably was his idea in the first place. Like, let's throw rocks, and then now they're throwing them, and this is just what they chose to do today because they had a person who's in their life. This is the like stark contrast between a disembodied irrelational church experience where I come in and it's pretty anonymous and it's pretty disconnected from my actual life, and people don't really see how I talk to my wife or how I handle my kids or the actual struggles I'm going through, or they can't really bear my burdens. They can't really talk to me about the good or the bad or the ugly of my life. And microchurches, they're not, there's nothing special about it. It's just a church that's small enough to know you and to stand on the corner with you with whatever they're up to. So I think if you're talking about discipleship, like real life encounters with each other, it has to be small. It has to be
so good.
Even if you were in a big church and thought big churches are amazing, which I have no problem with that. That's great. But even within a bigger church, I think you're looking for microchurches. You're still trying to find a way to be in a smaller thing so that real discipleship can happen. I mean, what do you think? Is it even possible to disciple people from that without relationship, without real connection?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, you look at Jesus with his, you know, he had crowds, but a crowd accomplished something different. And then you could see where he's got, you know, the 72, and then he's got the 12, and then he's got the 3. In each one of those levels accomplished something different. And I look back to John Wesley, right? Because in the West, at least, it seems like Wesley might have been the closest to, trying to reproduce what Jesus did. And even where he had, you know, his classes, bands, and societies. And in the book, I kind of have a chart that talks about him, and they each accomplished something different. Wesley kind of saw that in the scripture and mimicked it and created this incredible movement. And I think that ability to read the Bible and not see what's there is just like, I hope they don't put that on my tombstone, but that's what it constantly feels like when I'm like, why didn't I get this like 20 years ago? This would have been really helpful information for me because, you know, when I was young, it was, how could I rock a crowd? I came from megachurch, you know, and I led a megachurch at a very young age, and it grew and it was exciting. And then had a Holy Spirit encounter where he just said, you're not the dude. And I was like, oh, I was the interim pastor for a year and a half. And then I ended up, it's funny how you say this, because locked away in my church office, it wasn't until 9/11 hit. I'm in Wales in steelworking town of Port Talbot, Lloyd Jones's church, working as the evangelist, and nothing I did worked. And you mentioned proximity. And when I started to go work in a factory and I was working alongside like these blue collar, tough dudes, man, and we'd end up in the canteen and we'd end up talking, they all started coming to faith. And these are people I couldn't reach to save my life. But that whole disciple-making thing started happening. And I remember thinking back then, maybe this is why Paul worked with his hands, so he could be around people, you know? But I didn't know, you know, at that time that I was actually becoming more like Jesus or Paul in my ministry than what I had been aspiring to, if that makes sense. Mm.
I also think, I don't know if you agree with this, but I also think that there's a kind of like good discipleship is specialized, you know, in the sense that I think people in full-time ministry, clergy, whatever, we tend to think of discipleship as generalized. We just tell principles and then people have to figure out how to apply them. But if you're actually trying to like, okay, but how do I do this as a steel worker? Or how do I do this as a plumber? How do I do this as a school teacher? Something is lost between this general principle that I'm told and then actually being a school teacher and bringing the kingdom into that environment. And the only way to really do that is to have somebody who's also struggling with that with you, or is maybe a few steps ahead of you, who has brought the kingdom in some ways into their classroom and so on. Mm. You can see that, you can try it, and you can work with them. So that level of contextualization or specialization can only happen if you're in the trenches with that kind of, in that kind of field or work or sphere or whatever. Mm. And a pastor of a big church just can't know how to do that. They don't know how to be a school teacher and bring the kingdom there and be a disciple of Jesus in that particular environment. And so they have no choice but to generalize everything. And then, yeah. So then we again, it's another way we're disembodying Jesus's stuff, where it's stuff we think about, but not really, we don't really know how to do it. Know what I mean?
Yeah. That was the whole point of the book for me was Plantology was planting in the way of Paul and the apostles, finding universal principles. But this was more disciple making in the way of Jesus, because let's be honest, no one's going to be better than him at it, right? So I was like, okay, what am I missing? And I actually went on a journey in my personal devotions of taking a chronological gospels and just trying to trace what was he doing at what stage to develop them. And for a number of years, I had kind of been convinced that everything Jesus said fell into three buckets: time, teaching, and tactics. And when I started studying his 3 years, I mean, there's a chart in there where I just show everything he did in year one. Boom. Yeah. And I do this for every year.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
And you're like, my gosh, most of it was just spending time with him. That first year was the time year. The second one, he says, hey, we got to go to other cities. He says, the time has come. It originally tells his mom, the time is not my time. In that first year, he's going to go on this, and that's his year of popularity and things scaling up. But that's the year where he takes the disciples and says, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. He trains them. And then in year three, he tactically sends them. It's the first time they've done miracles in the third year. Once I saw that framework, I was like, okay, this is mind blowing. But it also, this is what I love about Jesus and Paul. As soon as you think you have them figured out, they throw you for a loop. So like, Paul switches. I can trace out. I train planners. I could trace out this is what he did on his first missionary journey, but he keeps switching it up. Well, Jesus has time, teaching, and tactics, but you can enter that flywheel at any point. Like I know for you in the underground, right? Your people would be tactically engaging with the community, and other people say, hey, we want to join that mission. They enter the flywheel mobilization at the tactical point. They're not even believers yet, but they want to help with this mission you guys are on in the community. Then they start with proximity. They start getting the timepiece. You know, we're spending time with you, and then they start hearing the teaching off these people. I want to know more about Jesus. Like that's how you can enter the flywheel at any point. And that's what I love. Like the Samaritan woman is a key example. Jesus does something different with her than he does with the disciples. And then the way she approaches her village, they enter the flywheel different place. Like it's totally crazy, you know? Huh.
Yeah. Your treatment of really the Gospels and Acts and your, how conversant you are with is, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I was very impressed with your thoroughness, but it's not inaccessibly thorough. You know, you're not a stodgy academic reading. It's this very living, practical. But dude, your hardcore analytics is really good, really remarkable.
Oh, well, thank you, brother. I you know what it felt like to me was I was geeking out. Like I was just on.
Yeah, you were geeking. Exactly. That's exactly right.
It's just like, hey guys, I'm stupid. I didn't know all this. Come with me on this journey and let's figure, you know, let's discover this together. I'm 5 minutes ahead going, check this out. but man, I just, you know, and with you, man, like the practitioner, that you've been over the years, like just the, I know the Underground Network represents thousands of stories of this happening in real life. And so as you guys disciple make, really all of your networks were relational networks. And those relational networks would help form new micro churches. That's exactly what we're seeing with the discipology process, right? I actually think you guys did all of this, exactly what I'm writing about. You guys are, you were just practicing all of this years ago. How did your disciple making that led to relational networks form micro churches?
Yeah, I think obviously the word you're using is I think mobilization, and you talk about like the kind of evolution of missional theology or missional thinking into mobilization, and maybe the limits of, which I thought was quite provocative by you, by the way.
I was a little naughty there, perhaps.
Yeah, well, but good. I mean, I take it on board. Like if you I think you're talking about kind of church growth into missional, yeah. but then it needs to move into mobilization, the sort of the dawn of this other idea. But and I would kind of agree with that. I think that, you know, missional theology, centering the mission of God as a starting point, is profound and important, but it has to, like, people have to take hold of it somehow, which is I think your point about mobilization. So I really like that. But I think what I would add, and I think maybe from the underground story, is that what mobilization has looked like is calling. You know, like you have to say, where are you going to be mobilized? So you can generalize, you can say, I'm going to go make disciples. But I do think a missing piece, and even in your work, you talk about the how and the why and the what.
Yeah.
So I would say calling is like the where. It's the question of like, you got to do it somewhere.
Yes.
It kind of doesn't matter in a sense, like just do it somewhere, you know, just make disciples somewhere. But I think it matters to us on a personal level. So like the difference between an intrinsic motivation to do something and an extrinsic, a lot of our church systems rely on extrinsic motivations. That is like social rewards, you know, groupthink, whatever, these kind of piety, kind of collectivistic piety, and the downside of that, or even great visionary leadership, which is like, ooh, that sounds good, I should do that because that person's smart and they have a good idea. None of those things kind of last because they're extrinsic. You know, they come from the outside. In my experience, in our experience, I would say when there's intrinsic motivation, that is to say, something about this is inside me already, then those things tend to persevere. There's a more sustainability. So I think the relationship between how new microchurches are formed or new ministries is formed is about the where. It's about discovering, I really have like a deep concern for that group of people or that place. You know, somebody that's had a cancer diagnosis, for example, or survived cancer, you know, they're in a group now. And it's not something they even necessarily wanted. Maybe the victim of abuse, the someone's gone through a divorce. Like, they can actually be negative experiences, but they give you a heart for people who've been through divorce. They give you a heart for people who've gotten a cancer diagnosis. They give you credibility in that space, and you're intrinsically concerned. You know, I think if you have a kid with autism or something, and then you think, other parents who find out their kid has autism or dealing with or trying to navigate that world and see their kid thrive or flourish or whatever, and the struggles they have, you feel that for them. You don't need somebody, you don't need some church program to tell you why that's important. You know it's important. And you wake up every morning thinking, anybody who's going through this, I care about them. And that's what I mean by calling, of course, it is vertical. You know, it's something that we get from God. But it's almost always, that vertical almost always touches something very, very personal to us.
Yeah.
And that answering the where, I guess, is how new microchurches get formed. That's how new ministries get formed, because someone goes, man, is anybody going to care for this particular kind of person? And then you go, I guess it's me. You know, maybe it has to be me. And that's how new things get birthed.
I love it, man. That actually is where the book kind of ends, the final chapter in it. The breakdown of the book is, and I couldn't do it this way without confusing people, but three sections: time, teaching, tactics. But it was like a fractal. What I did is, in each of those sections, there was a time chapter, a teaching, which would be the principal chapter, and then the tactical. So, but I used three P's, so not to confuse people, like the time of time, the tactics of time. That's what I was trying to do, but what I did, it basically came out as patterns, principles, and practices so that people didn't get confused, but they could still kind of see the framework. But the very last one is the practices of the tactical rhythm. And in that one, we talk about the where. And it's funny you say this because I almost, that's the whole next book, which would be called Reachology, which is because this leads to small groups. Whenever you've made a disciple, I don't know about you, but if I'm disciple making, and I always do it with someone else, somebody always, every time, hey, can my brother come? You end up with a group. So because this is going out, like we've got an app where people can go through this. They don't need the book, right? They're reporting back, then we can track the groups as they're growing digitally, but we have people that have like eight groups of six people, and basically eight micro churches going, and you're like, dude, wow. And it's the thing that's happening is they're suddenly creating these communities of people that are following Jesus. The next thing to me is now this community needing to engage on mission together, right? Because you and I are missional people, right? But what the underground does is, you know, whereas we're trying, what I love about the underground starts with the where, you know what I'm saying? Like it really starts there. And once my church was established, that would always be forward movement. You know, it was always the where question. This is kind of maybe before that, where I think this, okay, I'm going to be provocative again. I did not say this in the book, but the way that everything is structured tells you this is what I think. I wrote the Catalyst Guide for the leader, but I wrote the MVP is that pathway, you know, the app, because it doesn't need anything but a willing heart, right? And because I believe that the leaders are the bottlenecks to this. And I think when Jesus came, he kind of bypassed a lot of the leaders of his day, just picked some teenagers and said, let's go.
Yeah, for sure. And, yeah, for
and,
sure.
And to be honest, it's a little bit, it's a little cheeky of me, but that's really what we're doing is we're actually bypassing. My hope is, I was talking to some of the guys at different organizations that focus on discipleship and disciple making. And I was talking to one group and they said, after nearly three decades trying to do this, we can't seem to mobilize leaders to take this on board. And I'm like, that's because we don't start with them, you know? Yeah. And I love, but that where question is so important, brother. And in the next book, that's the entire focus. But that last chapter, I was like, yes. I can't end the book without going there into that. And so I'm glad you pointed that out, because I am looking for a co-author for the next book. I'm just saying. But anyways, for you, in your experience, I know like what you've kind of been careful, and I think I'm reading the subtext, what you've been doing, and I think it's important, is to not divorce disciple making as a term or even as a practice from the everyday rhythms of your life, right? And I think that's what Jesus did so well in his first year, right? Before he left Capernaum, he moves there and shows them what disciple making looks like, just while you're working your job and, you know, all that stuff. What does it look like for you when it's actually working? What does disciple making on the ground look like in an underground context?
I don't want to be religious, or I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, but I've spent my whole life like you. I'm thinking about systems and ministry practices, and I obviously that's very, very important to me. But the truth is, none of this stuff works without God. You know, it can't, or it shouldn't. Mm. And if it does work without God, something's quite wrong with it. You know. Yeah. So I guess I just, when it's working, whatever that means, it means that there's this sort of invisible variable that is just God's sovereign choice to take your feeble attempts and at faithfulness, at good, healthy, repeatable practices, and gives it life, you know, breathes into it. I just think that the defining characteristic of disciple making moments is the presence of God, is the work of God. Amen. It's something that, like, you couldn't do that part. You know, it's like you can, it's almost, if you think of an equation, if you have an equation that makes disciples that leaves God out, like God is not part of the equation, that's effectively, that's practically atheistic. It's, you don't really believe in God. So you can have a discipleship pattern that doesn't actually believe in God. So there needs to be, like, you do this, you know, it's A plus B plus C, and A, we can define, you do, B, you could do, the other people do, they're open. C, that's up to God. Like, it's just a, if that variable doesn't happen, if God doesn't do something in your equation, it simply will not happen. And definitely not movement. Definitely not. I mean, movement you'd have to define as something which is outside the control of controls. So things that mean to control, things that are set up to control, which is not always a bad thing. I'm not saying that in a pejorative sense. But movement is to break out of controls. So whatever those organizational, institutional enterprise of control is, it exceeds that. It somehow moves beyond that. So you can build good systems, have good disciplines and practices, but at the end of the day, there is a part that only God can play. I think about, you know, my part of my early theological training was in, like, Latin American theology. And you got, so in the story of kind of Latin America, you have, 50s, 60s, 70s, you have this emerging idea coming out of Catholic theology of this sort of preferential option for the poor, that God cares about the liberation of the poor. Because, well, the long story is that Vatican II says, you know, 1961, whatever, 62, Vatican II says the church is the people of God. Mm. Like, that's the ship. The church is not Rome. The church is the people. And so then the Latin American bishops, they get together in Medellin and they say, okay, well, what does that mean for us? Who are the people of God in Latin America at the time? They're the poor. So you go, okay, if the church is the people of God, and in Latin America, the people of God are poor, then the church is the poor. So then we say, okay, well, how do we reach the poor? So they developed these systems. They're what they call based communities. And based communities were basically microchurches, and they were meant to, like, empower the poor to apply the Bible in life and society. So to read the scriptures together and to come up with the sort of the power and the creativity to deal with, like, let's build a road, let's do some political action, let's whatever. And so they designed this, what I think is a quite profound and beautiful approach to, like, bringing the church to the people, bringing the church to the people of God, right? But there's a saying in Spanish at this time that liberation theology came for the poor, but the poor went to the Pentecostals. So while all this system is being designed in quite a thoughtful, I think, good way, poor people became Pentecostals. So, like, it didn't work. The system didn't really empower people. I mean, it did, of course, at some level, in some human sense, it did.
Yeah.
But poor people the Pentecostals exploded.
Right.
In the mid 20th century. I mean, it's like one of the great numeric revivals in human history.
Yeah.
And why did poor people go to the Pentecostals? You know, because the Pentecostals told you can have the power of God today.
Right.
You can walk in here like a farmer, and you can walk out of here an evangelist. Mm. That the Spirit of God can land on you tonight.
Yeah.
And give you gifts, pour gifts into you, and you can walk out of here with a new identity as a apostle, disciple maker. Like, the empowerment which liberation theology was trying to give to the people through a system, came in the form of this spontaneous outpouring of God's power, his presence. So whatever we do, and again, don't get me wrong, I'm like more of a backsliding Pentecostal. I'm like a lapsed Pentecostal. I believe in it. I'm just a bad Pentecostal. Yeah. I really, really, really believe in it. But yeah, I'm more prone towards a system thinker. I'm more prone towards that kind of stuff. But
yeah,
I think, and you are too, you're very good at this, but we have to admit together that at the end of the day, it's the Spirit of God being poured out on us that is what makes it work.
You know, it's rad that you say that, because that was one of the things, even in looking at the Great Commission, it has to be. Like, even our entire last week on the tactical piece, where we're trying to train you, it's all about the Holy Spirit. We just use Matthew 10. It's all dependence on the Spirit. That's what he tells them. And twice, the gospel, Luke gives it twice. He gives it once to the 12 and once to the 72. Almost word for word instructions. You're like, Luke wants you to really know about the Holy Spirit, to depend. Yep. And when Jesus gives that great commission, right? I never understood this before. Those five tactics, once you see them linked up with the apest, now it makes sense why Jesus said, go do these five things, but wait for the power.
Yeah.
Wait for power to come. I never had seen that connection until I started working on this book. That's why, because the five tactics were not enough. There had to be this empowering to do those. You could say, oh, hey, we trained with Jesus for 3 years, right? Nobody could be better trained than those 12. And Jesus tells them, you're not ready. Not without my Spirit. Yeah. Come on,
that's
right?
That's quite good.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, brother, I love you, man. I love your heart. I love your, and I just am so grateful that I know you're a busy dude. I'm VP of Impact Alliances for National Christian Foundation. It's a big deal. So thanks for coming on, man. We're out of time. But guys, I want to not only thank Brian on your behalf, but thank you on our behalf for listening and tuning in to the Church Planter Podcast. My guest has been Brian Sanders, author of many books. Definitely pick up The Underground Church. If you are one of the few people out there that does not know about or has not read that book, grab it. And then please do yourself a favor and pick up The Six Seasons of Calling. You will not be sorry. Again, guys, this has been the Church Planter Podcast. I'm your host, Peyton Jones, reminding you, if you want to reach the people nobody's reaching, you need to go where nobody's going and do what nobody's doing.